And welcome. Today is the 1st of July, 2008. Did anybody work with that mantra, the Sudarshan Chakra mantra?
Yep.
We did last week. Mm-hmm. Anything to report with that?
I finally got to be able to say it so that I could get the chakra moving at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a feat in itself.
Excellent.
So I enjoyed that really. I'm not sure of my pronunciation at this stage.
Does that matter actually about pronunciation so much in the beginning? I mean, actually, I'm trying to lift my voice as well.
It doesn't matter in the sense that one is trying to learn, and one, if one is approaching this with an attitude of humility, reverence,
good intention,
open-heartedness, respect, then no, it doesn't matter. It's really about the attitude. It's like anything. It's really about the attitude. You know, after time, having heard something repeatedly, then one assumes that one learns how to say it correctly. But, you know, even with some of the Irish people, their Irish isn't all that great.
Okay. You don't pronounce the G. You just
No, you don't. That
some,
Yeah. Om, sung, hung.
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 Strong.
Strong. Strong.
Rung.
Rung. Rung, like the rung of a ladder. Rung. Hung. Fuck.
Fuck.
Fuck. Yeah. Om, sung, hung, strong, rung, hung, fuck. So that will act. That's last week's. Yeah. That will activate the chakra.
I was using it
as
a healing tech mantra.
Yeah.
I'm stepping up.
We're using it on self?
Self. And it is working. Definitely. So just keep doing it.
Just keep doing it.
And then I do it for, you know, a month or so.
Yeah.
See how it goes.
Excellent. Very good.
I feel the car a lot.
Yeah, well, that's it. You see, with mantras, you can drive down
anytime,
the street, anytime, any place, anywhere.
Mm.
Waiting for an airplane.
Mm.
Waiting for anything. Anytime. You know, because it doesn't really disturb you. I mean, meditation, pretty much, you don't do behind the wheel of a car, strictly speaking. Whereas a mantra, you can. Sorry?
I find it's the best time to switch when I'm driving along.
Well, kind of, if you were going on a long journey, more often than not, we go into the waking dream. We go into the daydream. Mm-hmm. And we go into automatic mode in terms of operation of the vehicle. And we can do that. And, you know, that can be done. But it's not recommended, you know. All right. So any other reports on mantra from anybody? I asked you a couple of weeks ago, and then I forgot again last week, if you have any good stories, spirit in action, where something unusual, extraordinary happened, which would give an example of spirit moving in your life, or some dynamic divine hand in things. So if you have any examples of that, I'd appreciate that. Okay. Tonight we're going to talk about a few things, and we're going to wander from one thing to another here. Let's begin with our important earthly plans. and how important our earthly plans are and how attached to those plans and schemes we are. And we're just simply too busy to take time out of our lives to focus on what is truly important, which is spirit, which is soul, which is that which is eternal. Because no matter how important you are and what you're doing, it's got a date stamp on it. Use by date. And it comes to an end. Problem is that most of us do not know what that date is. But we are nonetheless caught up in our various earthly plans. This is a very interesting story, or humorous story, about Indra. And Indra, according to Vedic lore, is the king of the gods. This is the middle planetary system where we live, the earthly plane, populated primarily by humans. Well, there's lots of other species too, but humans are kind of the high man on the totem pole here. Down in the lower realms, the hellish realms, we have the demons, or the darker forces, the forces that are create more havoc, more self-interested. And the upper regions are inhabited by the devas, the gods. In Christianity, we'd say angels, archangels. Devas or devis, gods. The root word of deva is div, which means to shine. Those who shine. That's where you get the word divine, divine, divinity. Sanskrit. Pardon? Devi. Yeah. Devi. It's from Devi. Yeah. So the devis are the goddesses. The devas are the gods. They live in the higher realms. So Indra is the king up there. And Indra called the architect Vishvakarma. Vishvakarma is very famous in Vedic lore. He is the architect of the gods, and he builds fabulous places, generally temples and palaces. That's kind of his thing. Small buildings, not so much. He builds entire cities. So Indra, who happens to, in the position of king of the gods, is a position. Just like the prime minister is a position. It's held by whomever, so-and-so, whatever his name might be. You know, Brian Cowan might be the prime minister, as it is here. And then somebody else takes over. So it's position. So Indra is the position. So Indra, at the time, asked Vishvakarma to build him a palace that would benefit his status as king of the gods. Hey, I'm king of the gods here. So this place better be good, you know, because when people walk in, I need them to be blown away. It's the only way it's good. There's a little bit of ego in there. Exactly. Every time Vishvakarma had completed the construction of the palace, Indra said, nah, this doesn't work. It needs to be bigger, grander, more impressive. So back to the drawing board, you know, add on here, add on there, you know. If he's dealing with Board Planola, he's waiting for years trying to get planning permission, as we all know here in Ireland. Nothing seemed to satisfy him. Finally, Vishvakarma went to Brahma. Brahma is the creator of everything in the material universe. Brahma is also a position. And he said, well, you know, I'm just tired of this with Indra. I can't get on with any other work because it's never good enough for this guy. It's always got to be grander and bigger and larger. And can you do something? Can you speak to him? Can you do something? So Brahma went to Vishnu. He thought, I'll just leave this with Vishnu. Vishnu is? God. Vishnu's God. So he said, you know, here's the scene. Can you sort this out for us, please? Vishwakarma's got other things to do. So Vishnu took the form of a little boy. Just looked like a little kid. And he wandered on into Indra's palace one day. Like that, looking around. Indra welcomed him, because you have to welcome your guests. That's proper protocol. And he asked the child, well, what brings you here? And the child said, I just wanted to see if your palace was better than the palace of the Indra before you. What do you mean, Indra before me? Aren't I the only Indra? He said, No. There were many, many Indras before you. And there will be many, many Indras when you're gone. You know. Endless supply of Indras. Numberless Indras. And not only that, as we speak, there are numberless Indras in parallel worlds. Well, this came as a great shock to Indra. And Vishnu, as a child, says, you know, you might say you're like a grain of on the beach of Indras. So this really deflated him. He said, when you blink, a human dies. And when Brahma blinks, an Indra dies. And when Shiva blinks, a Brahma dies. And when Vishnu blinks, a Shiva dies. So there's your pecking order. And we're all operating on a different time band. Right? We've discussed this. So if that's a central point, this is a human lifetime going around. You know. There's the gods going around. So, knowledge of his insignificance in the cosmic scheme of things finally humbled Indra, which was the point. And he stopped making his palace grander and bigger. He knew then that no matter how hard he tried, there'd always be someone who was better and more important than him. So then he began to inquire, Atato Brahma Jigyasa. Now is the time to inquire into the absolute truth. What am I really about? What is my life really about? What is the real purpose of my life? So, the next time we think about how important our earthly plans are, we can think about this story with Indra and his palace. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about practicing your Dharma. What makes the world go round and keeps everything in a perfect mesh and sync is the agreement that each person will practice their dharma, their duty, according to their nature. in the current age that we live in, which is the Iron Age, or the age of Kali in the universe, of the four ages we've talked about so many times. This is the Iron Age, the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. This is the shortest age of them all. This is like the winter of the universe. Excuse me, when things begin to fall apart big time. And consciousness and awareness diminishes significantly in this age. People are not interested in higher consciousness. They're interested in sense gratification. If you don't believe me, go look at the billboards and signs, and you'll see what they're interested in. So the way everything works properly is if everybody follows their dharma. So if you're a Brahmin, an intellectual, or a priestly type, or a healer, that kind of person, then you shouldn't be lowering yourself to a station doing work that's beneath you, for example. And if you're somebody who, in other words, whatever you do should be in accordance with your nature, and you should be doing work in accordance with your nature and not trying to go above it or below it, because that's artificial. And it results in a disruption of the harmony. What you see in Kali Yuga, in the Iron Age, very often now, is that people who are Shudras, which means simple people like laborers, etc., which is fine, aspire to positions of clergy. And they will be heads of religions and churches. Or they will be in government. People who have no... Government is the second level, which is Kshatriya, which is warriors and governors and protectors and people who are there to look after the welfare of everybody. This is by nature, you know. And if somebody who has no qualification for that then either runs for office or becomes a dictator, there's a big problem now in Zimbabwe with Mugabe, who's now said that he's won this latest election. The people are in utter despair in this place. And the inflation rate is 14,000%. More than 14,000?
No, one sterling is equal to something like 1 billion.
Yeah, okay, more than that then. It's crazy. So the point is, this is an example of somebody who is unqualified to be in this position. This is the point. Whoever should be in that position should be somebody who is qualified to lead, to govern, to manage, and who genuinely cares about the welfare of the people. Most important thing. Okay? And if that doesn't happen, Zimbabwe at this moment happens to be a stellar example of the result. Okay? You with me on that? So, now we'll talk a little bit about Lord Ram. Lord Ram was an incarnation of Vishnu, God, who appeared in the Treta Yuga, the Silver Age, many thousands of years ago, when people's consciousness was much higher. And Ram, by nature, in his incarnation, was a warrior prince. He was born into a royal family, so that was his dharma, to take care of the people and to lead the people. So Ram was known to be the epitome of dharma, and he upheld the code of dharma perfectly. Everything in his kingdom therefore moved in a predictable rhythm. And what you can, when you read the Vedas, you'll find that when everybody's acting in accordance with their dharma, it only rains when it's supposed to. You will not have natural disasters. They will automatically be eliminated. There will be no drought. There will be no inflation. There will be enough rain. There will be no floods or earthquakes or tsunamis. And that is symptomatic of everybody in the right place at the right time in harmony. We've never experienced this currently, all right? And it's, we're not genuine, actually supposed to in this age. So everything moved in a predictable rhythm. One day, you're okay, you're all right. But one day, a boy died before his father. And somebody ran to Ram. Ram, Ram, Majesty. A boy has died before his father in your kingdom. How could this have happened? Untimely death. Children are never supposed to die before the parents. It's considered bad karma. We all know that. And the worst thing, any of those of you who have had children can imagine, is the thought of having your child die. Correct? So, the father of the child, who was a Brahmin, who was a priestly guy, upholding Dharma, practicing spiritual practice, meditation, counseling others, he went to Ram and he accused Ram of not upholding Dharma. It's got to be your fault. You're the king. The buck stops here. The king. So you're asleep at the switch. Why has this happened? My son has died. Ram consulted the rishis, the sages. They informed him that a Shudra, a laborer type of person, was busy, his name was Shambhuka, was busy practicing Brahman practices, spirituality. He was busy practicing meditation, asceticism, penance, but he was a Shudra. Okay? Tapas, penance. The rishis further explained. Now, this is a different way to say the four ages. And I'd never heard it like this. The world has four ages, just like man. Childhood, youth, maturity, and old age. So, golden age, silver age, bronze age, iron age. Iron age is maturity. Old age, pardon me. In its childhood, or in the silver age, the golden age, sorry, only the priestly class of Brahmins are allowed to become sages, practice spiritual practices, and elevate their consciousness. In the youth, the warrior caste or princely caste or kshatriyas, they can also practice spirituality. That's in the silver age. In the bronze age, the Brahmins, the kshatriyas, and the vaishyas are business people. They are also allowed to practice spirituality. Yeah. And in the Iron Age, now, all parts of society is allowed to practice spirituality. There's a statement in the Vedas that says, Kalao Shudra Sambhava. that in this day and age, all that are born are Shudras, are not very evolved souls, no offense. But a lot of the qualification is missing. Okay. The current era, when this story was taking place, was the Golden Age. And this guy, Shambhuka, the worker, was breaking the code of Dharma by acting like a sage, acting like a rishi, as Mugabe is breaking the code of Dharma by acting like a leader. The resulting cosmic chaos has caused the boy to die. Ram immediately went to the forest and beheaded Shambhuka. That's what he did. And immediately, Dharma. Well,
he's doing the best.
No, no, he was overstepping his.
It was the golden age.
I just explained it all to you, how it all worked.
Could you go with the laborers, could you get right down the bottom of the top?
Okay, alright. But you have to understand, when somebody dies at the hands of an incarnation of God, the soul is liberated and they return to the spiritual world. So you can't look at it from the only a human point of view. From a human point of view, it seems cruel and unusual punishment. And we tend to be, you know, I don't disagree with you, but we tend to be a little sentimental about these things, not realizing that at the very least he would get a higher birth. But in this case, that soul will be liberated and never have to take birth again. That's the reality. He did him a favor. But the most important thing was to reestablish the harmony. So the whole point of the story is to try to point out to you that if everybody would follow their dharma and act in accordance with their nature, not try to act above themselves or below themselves, then we would have harmony. Yeah.
Does that make sense? Because for the past 2 weeks, I've been on Job Savali, as all you know, and I've been applying for like so many jobs because I just want a job. You know, so I could not understand why there was such a not an ease as I was applying for jobs. Because I'm wanting to get a job, but part of me is going, well, I mean, I could clean the floors, but I don't want to do that. I want to do something that I don't want to leave.
Okay, well, let's take you as an example. You're a good example. Now, you have to look at it in two different ways. The most important thing is your fundamental nature, your qualifications, your inclination, all right, to determine your dharma. Number one, you're born in a family of Brahmins. Your father's a doctor. That's a Brahmin. Okay? Now, that doesn't automatically mean that she's a Brahmin or has a similar nature, although in many cases it does.
There you are. You come from a Brahmi home in India. And you are all.
Yeah, but you see, exactly, but you know, many times those people are not that. So just to be born in the family is not reason enough. But we can see from that what kind of family you're born in. Now, are you a Brahmin? Well, maybe you are, and maybe you just don't do that. If you wanted to be an accountant, you'd be a Brahmin. If you want to be a brain surgeon, you'd be a Brahmin. If you want to be a lecturer at UCD, you'd be a Brahmin. If you want to clean the floor, If you want to clean the floor at some office building, you'd be a shudra, a laborer. Right. Whatever you think you might be, I don't know that cleaning the floor would really be reflective of your nature.
No, but you know. I know I identify.
Now, even though those things are Brahmins, those different jobs, one must be qualified to do those jobs.
Yeah.
You know. So that's the other side of it. But it's characteristic in the Iron Age that people either A, do not know what their dharma is, don't know where they fit. How many people do you know like this? Or B, knowing clearly where they fit, they cannot work in that arena. They can't get that job.
Why?
Sometimes for no qualification. Sometimes they don't believe in themselves. I mean, there may be, for example, very well-educated people who can't get hired. So therefore, they take a job that's beneath their station, so to speak. Look at a lot of these immigrants will come here and to other such countries. They'll be, you know, and not only them, but people would be driving taxi who have a...
Math
degree. Yeah, all kinds of degrees from another country.
Yeah.
Or they'll be waiting tables.
Yeah.
You see? So that is a symptom of that. Now, that's a little different because you got immigration and all these other things. But, again, back to the point, if everything is as it should be, then everybody would be doing the job or following the career that is exactly reflective of their nature. Subsequently, they would be rightly situated and they would be happy in their work. Not miserable. Yeah, so that story, it's a bit of an eye-opener, but...
That is the truth, and I think I need to be humble there. Because I know that from doing my chat... how it has really helped me, you know, kind of confirm who I am, and I'm just not afraid of it.
Yeah.
You know, whereas before I thought, should be shy, don't be this way, this is who I am, so uncomfortable and things,
Knowledge, arguably, is the most valuable thing.
Yeah.
And not that knowledge is power, which is what they say in this society, you know, knowledge is power. It is power, but then people start to think, yeah, well, I can get power over somebody because I have knowledge. That's not what we mean. But knowledge brings enlightenment, and that reduces stress because it reduces ignorance. And if you know how things work, how they're meant to work, like having your chart done, I mean, it's so valuable because you'll know what you're going through, why you're going through it, how long it lasts, when it began, what you're supposed to learn while you're going through it, when it's supposed to end, and for the most part, it's pretty accurate. You know, and I mean, that's of great value. That takes so much stress and angst out of your life when you have that information. Yeah, I mean, when I sort of fortunately stumbled into it, I just thought, oh my God, boy, this is just unbelievably valuable for people, you know. And I didn't want to do charts. I never wanted to do charts for anybody. I never wanted to become an astrologer. I never... Well, when I grow up, I'm going to be an astrologer. It's the last thing I would have wanted to be because people will never take me seriously. You know, I'm a guy that likes to be taken seriously. You tell me you're an astrologer, people just look at you. Right. Like that. Well, you know what? Everybody will find out, believe you me. And I had to surrender. I had to surrender big time to that. I did not choose this. That chose me. And off it went. And I went in the slipstream. You know.
That's what happens when you are open
into it and you're going to grow, it will just fall.
Correct. Now, here's another nice little story from the Vedas to give you perspective. The sage Markandeya was a very, very evolved sage or rishi, but he'd be like up at the top of the universal pyramid. He'd be very close to Brahma, the creator, like the next rung down. When we say Brahma, the creator, we don't mean God. We mean God's representative in the material world, who creates everything, all the diversity, according to Vedic understanding. It's, again, a position, like Indra. Could you be Brahma the creator? Yes, you could. But you're going to have to be a very, very elevated soul. The position is open. You may apply, Catherine. Why can't I be Brahma?
Brahma, where are you?
Are we not all Brahma? Because really, we can create things.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Correct. We are all creative beings. It is a fact that elevated yogis, in other words, elevated souls, through the practice and knowledge of yoga, can create whole universes. That is possible. So for Brahma to, what is Brahma but a yogi who knows how to create a universe and stick a few plants and animals in it? A little more to it than that, but that's the concept. So absolutely true. What level do you want to do it on? You know. So, Markandeya, the sage, had a vision or a dream. In his vision, dark clouds covered the sky. Torrential rain lashed the earth. Rivers broke their banks and the sea tossed. Pardon me. Furiously. Pardon? That's, yes, this is Irish weather forecast. Oceans began to overflow. Terrified, Markandeya sought refuge on a banyan tree. Banyan tree is a sacred fig tree. We have one here. We have a, what do you call them? No. Bonsai. Bonsai version of the sacred banyan. One of the leaves, cradled by the violent waves, caught his eye. And on this leaf, he saw a beautiful child in miniature, radiant like the sun, sucking his toe, as babies do, gurgling with joy. What he did not know was this child, floating on these waves, on this banyan leaf, was Vishnu himself, in his pastime of gurgling baby, laughing, having a heck of a time. He's riding the waves. And this is a very famous painting. You've seen this painting many times. This is the story. The child then took a breath and inhaled Markandeya and everything else into his body. Inside the body of God. Inside this body, he saw a whole new world. Celestial regions populated by the gods, the goddesses, nether worlds populated by demons, and earthly planets populated with plants, animals, nymphs, fairies, gnomes, giants, and dwarves, a few leprechauns. everything was as perfect inside as it was imperfect outside. Everything, all the worlds within the body of God were perfect. And this was a reflection of everything outside, but everything outside was imperfect. Material world, spiritual world. Reflection. People say, well, the spiritual world's just nothing. Just energy. Nothing exists there. The Buddhists say it's nirvana, cessation of existence. Well, then what is it? It's nothing. It's everything the opposite of this. But here you're being told, no, it's exactly this, but without all the flaws. That's what you're being told. At the next moment, the child exhaled, and everything rushed back out of the mouth of the baby. And Markandeya found himself surrounded once again by the unrelenting cataclysm and clinging to the banyan tree. This time, his whole perspective changed. No longer any fear of the imminent destruction. He faced it with faith, not fear, thanks to the child who lay on the banyan leaf. So, the image combines symbols of change. Now he's talking about the symbolism in the image. Symbols of change, which is water, permanence, the banyan leaf, regeneration, the baby. It helps the devotee or the spiritual aspirant to accept that although change is inevitable, everything regenerates and eventually one aspect remains permanent, the grace of God. So that's an interesting story. Yeah? Okay. Now, which one is you? Which point of view or which approach is you? When you contemplate or are faced with A, the will of God, B, the work of nature, or the effects of nature, or three, the effects of karma, how do you approach it? How do you respond to it? Through confrontation, through escape, or through acceptance? Confrontation, escape, or acceptance? Acceptance? Glindy?
Mixture?
Paul?
Acceptance, but ultimately escape.
Okay, very good. Honest man. Okay, so the question, Catherine.
Yeah.
When you contemplate or are faced with the will of God, the work of nature, or the effects of karma, what do? How do you respond? Confrontation, escape, or acceptance?
Depends on the situation.
Gray?
I would say it depends on the situation.
Okay. Arla?
I would say it depends on the situation, but I'm actually moving more to an acceptance in a lot of things that I wouldn't have before.
Okay, and before you would have?
Beat the shit out of them.
That's so called confrontation. That's confrontation.
So confrontation.
It doesn't say anything here about beat the shit out of anybody.
Sorry.
Fool me? Neve?
Probably a combination confrontation and then exactly.
Okay. Very good.
Can I ask a quick question? Sorry. So you're just asking if we're thinking about it now and whatever.
Well, now I'm going to enlighten you about
it. Are you saying like that, you know, oh, yeah, keep going. Should take my wallet. Actually, hang on.
I got more.
The way I would have accepted it, if it was taken, then it was meant to be.
Yeah.
That's what it means by acceptance.
If it happened, it was meant to be.
Yeah. Okay.
I would accept if I didn't see it happening and then it was gone. I would actually say, I hope they needed it more than I did.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're looking at these three things, confrontation, escape, and acceptance, more so from the spiritual point of view. Right? Confrontation is the belief that nature can be manipulated, controlled, or conquered. Nature or the circumstance can be manipulated, controlled, or conquered. So that's confrontation. Escape, the belief is that beyond the tribulations of nature waits a serene, higher reality waiting to be realized. So spiritual escapism means we can transcend it all. We can transcend this. We can get beyond it. And acceptance means all events, good or bad, result from the will of a higher power who is either impersonal and hence cannot be appealed to, or is personal and hence can be appealed to, worshipped, or appeased. Okay? So those are the three ways in which one can respond to these things. So, for confrontation, if your response is confrontation and your belief is that nature or circumstance can be manipulated, controlled, or conquered, then the rituals recommended are incantations, spells, sacrifices, and charms, talismans. And the belief that rituals are more powerful than the gods and they're more important than intellect or emotion. So you can take steps to confront these situations.
The only thing I would say about that is quite often you'll get a quicker result from stuff like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Escape is, and the belief that beyond the tribulations of nature waits a serene higher reality waiting to be realized. The rituals are meditation, asceticism, monasticism, manipulating the senses to transcend reality, meditation, or mystery of rituals needs to be understood or realized, or and the ritual is secondary to intellect. I'm not sure what he means by that, but anyway, you can transcend it. That's what it really comes down to, the ability to transcend it. And then the third one, acceptance, that all events, good or bad, result from the will of a higher power or karmic circumstance. And what you do in this case, covenants, prayers, offerings, penance, visiting a temple or a church. Rituals are an expression of love or allegiance, and or meant to develop love. So that is an acceptance. For me, all three. I do all three. I don't omit any of these, depending on the circumstance. Some things I just leave as they are, and some things, you know, I will confront. Any other comments about that? Now that we've filled it in a bit more.
So going back to what you said there, the last one about is it karmic that you know to do a ritual about it? Because that was something that came in from yesterday. I thought I wondered, was this a karmic thing for Tom? You know, that his money was taken
and yours wasn't.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, it is karmic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you were both sharing in the first part of the karma, which was to be accosted and invaded by thieves. With him, the thieves were successful, so that karma was fully fulfilled in that he lost the money. Mm-hmm. And for you, the thieves were intercepted. And the karma was not fulfilled, and you didn't lose the money.
Maybe she was protected.
Yeah, no, I know, but I'm just saying, ostensibly from the attack.
Like it's coming back, it's going to come back after again.
Not necessarily, no.
But I'm just wondering, in that, would the follow on be to go and do some
protection mantra or something?
Protection, yeah. I was, you know, chanting to Narasimha today.
Yeah.
And that. But I'm just wondering.
Well, clearly you are at this time, for whatever reason, mm-hmm. vulnerable to thievery, because it almost happened. So we can understand, because of that vulnerability, we want to put a ring or an aura or an energy of protection around you. So I don't think that's a bad idea at all. You know, maybe the karma played itself out with this circumstance and it won't happen again. But we don't know for sure. I'll tell you a story. When Kalindi and I moved into the field up top in Kilternan there, where I think you've all been, or most of you have been, with a view to die for and wind to die from. We moved in, of course, astrologically, at a certain time. You can only work with where the planets are in the sky. You can't move them around like chess pieces on a board. So all you can do is click the wheel and they are where they are. But you can move the wheel. So we picked the best time possible to move into the house, but in the second house of the move-in chart, we found Mars and K2, I believe. Mars and K2 in the second house is a slam dunk for robbery. You will be robbed. You will get ripped off. Somebody will steal. Now, good luck, because one of those planets would be enough, but the two of them together, you know, there's your gang. Now you got a gang, not just one person. So one of the first things we did, having moved into the place, is we did a sacred fire ceremony outside, proper one, with mantras, meant to appease Mars and K2, and then we also worshipped God in certain forms, like Nrsimha. You know, we're pretty good at being inclusive. But it was to pacify the potential negative energy of Mars and K2. So we were in there for maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I had a brand new credit card from Bank of Ireland. I hadn't even used it. I used it once back in Washington State because I still had some stuff to be shipped over. All right? I had to make this payment. It wasn't very much. It's like $150 or something. Then the next day we were going away to Mexico to Palenque, to the Mayan ruins, for a spiritual experience There was a, something that was organized to go. I got my credit card statement, the first one in the mail, and $3,000 had been stolen off my credit card. And I had only used it for one thing. New tires, rims, this, that, all kinds of...
I thought him had to drive. Yeah.
Oh, well.
He didn't clutch.
Yeah, he didn't clutch very well. So there it was. It, I mean, it happened, you know, it was in less than a month.
Do you think if you didn't do your ceremony, it would be worse?
No, you didn't let me finish the story.
I don't want that.
I had taken out the protection upon getting the credit card. So all of the money was restored.
That was your fire.
Now this here's another funny part. Yeah, that was the fire ceremony, the sacred fire. The lady for the moving company in Washington State, very nice lady, I said, Dolores, my credit card's been ripped off. Oh, no, that could never happen here. I said, yeah. I said, go out in your parking lot and see who's got new tires and rims. And that's who did it. So this was like, you know, noon our time, something like
that. You bought all the stuff online. You know, you bought
no, not all of it, I don't think.
You sure?
Not all of it.
Let's tell the story here.
And so I got a call later that same evening from Dolores and told me they got the guy. They got him in the same day. And he was the guy working in the office with her. I hired him myself. I said, And it turns out this guy had a record as long as my arm, you know.
When you saved it from probably a lot more.
So, and then the next series of calls I got were from the police in Washington State, you know. Anyway, so I didn't lose anything. That's my point. I got ripped off just like I was supposed to, but never lost anything.
You could have, like,
accepted
this.
Yeah, I've got a lot of the warrior spirit in me, and I don't roll over that easy. You know? Depending what it is, sometimes it's not worth the effort, but I find people stealing from you directly, I find that very invasive. I have a problem with it. It must be my ego. All right.
Wasn't it you and Brian Palmer?
And yeah, I wasn't there though.
No,
well, tell the story. That's a great story.
I had visiting the Yantra.
Yantra,
no, with it was Lakshmi and Ganesha. Mm-hmm. And I just told the girls, you know, it's on the table, just, you know, clean it in the morning.
Okay, Fumi had a jewelry counter in Brown Thomas for a time.
And it's just, they came in through Louis Vuitton entrance, and I was just coming on the ground floor. My counter is, they pass Louis Vuitton, and they come straight to the counter. And they ask the girl for change, or something like that. And the girls come and say, no, you know, you have to buy something before, you know, you can open the till. So they decide to buy something, so they can get a show. So the girls showed money, everything was cut, you know, on camera. But in the meantime, she just said she was scared, but she was touching whatever it is that I put on the counter, because I think I'm a weird boss anyway. She had all these weird things. Just do it. So she was touching it. But then,
she's touching Ganesh, or Lakshmi.
Ganesh and Lakshmi, because it was on the, you know, silver disc in the frame. So they didn't get money out of my till. And then they went to the next
But what she did was, she made... Did she make change for them?
Yeah, she gave them change.
She gave them change and immediately
shut the
cash drawer.
So they never
got anything.
But they bought something, yeah.
But they bought something. So she made a sale.
Oh, yeah.
So it was the days of the
No, her, the girl, the clerk.
Linda, I can't remember her name. And then they went to the bag department. And then they robbed the bag department. They couldn't rob my shit. They saw it on camera. And I said, what are you girls doing? Because they were touching this. What does that mean? So for me, put it there. And, you know, it's for protection. So they just
That's a great story. That's one that we should. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, make sure you made a sale.
Yeah, I can't remember what they paid, but they bought something.
Symbols. Symbols. All symbols can be divided into two groups from a spiritual perspective: fertility or monastic. Fertility symbols or monastic symbols. Fertility symbols are world-affirming and associated with life-giving ideas and are concerned with materialistic aspirations such as rebirth, birth, rebirth, experiencing pleasure, having children, gaining wealth, gaining power. Fertility symbols, expansion. Yep. Monastic symbols are world denying, transcendental ideas. They are concerned with spiritual goals such as truth, bliss, and immortality. The God of love, we call him Cupid. There comes from the Vedic concept of Cupid, who is called Kamadev or Kandarpa. The god of love, sex, desire, Kandarpa, is associated with symbols of fertility, naturally. His complexion is green, like tender leaves. He rides a parrot. And there's a beautiful picture we have of him. His complexion, oh, I said that. Like the Western Cupid, he carries a bow and an arrow. And his bow is made out of sugar cane. And his arrows are flowers. Cupid. Kandarpa. Or kama. Kama means desire or lust. General desire, kama. And so he has flower-tipped arrows. And he has five arrows for the five senses. And we have a beautiful...
You want to go better?
Would you? Please, we have a art piece of his wife, Cupid's wife. He has two wives. Can't remember the other one's name, but here's one we have.
Did you say he rides the parrot?
Parrot. The parrot, yeah. Ganesh rides the rat or the mouse.
Yeah.
Shiva rides the bull. He rides a parrot. The god of war rides a peacock. Indra rides an elephant. And that is Rati. R-A-T-I. Cupid's wife. And that's her sugarcane bow. You'll see the parrots also carved in there. Alright. She's lovely, huh? Got her in... New Delhi. Rati means sexuality, love, amorousness, romance. And it is the root of what word? Erotic. Erotica. Erotica. So there you have her. The fish serves as the emblem on Cupid's banner, Kama's banner. Kandarpa is considered the son of Brahma and the sustainer of the universe and the enemy of the destroyer, because he wants to keep everything going. His job is to entrap souls in the cycle of death and rebirth and to be an obstacle on the path of liberation. In order for us to play out our karma, we must keep coming back. What is arguably the single greatest urge in any of us? Sex drive. And people will do all kinds of dark things around it. Well, okay, yeah, food, but and sexual pleasure is considered to be heavenly pleasure. The pleasure of the heavenly realms. Why? Because it's so powerful that in the midst of it, you can't even think straight. Let's be honest. You lose your sense of everything. Fair enough. Fair enough.
You have to after it.
Come on. No, you're right.
Seriously, I mean, I've laid there and thought like most women, you need to get the pork chops out to go. Yeah. I have the pork chops in the freezer and I have to get them out. Will you hurry up? Sorry.
So,
you smile. Come on, it's funny.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny.
Good thing she's bored. Yeah.
It's so,
no wonder she's divorced.
Well, let me tell you a secret. I actually still haven't got around to my divorce because I'm only 11 years separated.
Okay. When consciousness raised, when consciousness expanded, then people became less concerned with sensual delights and materialism. And the symbols of Kandarpa, or the worship of Kandarpa, waned. Then sensuality became more acceptable if it was linked to devotion. And as a result, the symbols of Kandarpa mingled with the symbols of Vishnu, because in the form of, he's not there anymore, in the form of Krishna. And Krishna is somebody who plays with the milkmaids, dances in the forest, plays a flute. The Krishna is the most popular object of devotion. God as love. The sugar cane, fish-like earrings, peacock feathers, winsome looks, wild flowers, parrots, female companions, alluring music, and sensuous dances on moonlit nights on the banks of the river Yamuna in a flowery meadow came to be associated with Krishna. But similar to Cupid. But in Krishna, the love god's eroticism is tempered with devotion, and the yearning becomes spiritualized instead of for the physical sensual union. So your desire to experience sensuality and love and emotion is sublimated or raised up toward God rather than another person down here, which ultimately is mortal and ends with death. So that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Fertility rites versus monastic practices. In fertility rites, the aim is to harness the abundance of nature. In monastic practices, the aim is to break free from the control of nature. In fertility rites, all rituals symbolically communicate materialistic intentions to the cosmos. I want this, I need to achieve that, we need this, we have to expand that. In monasticism, all practices distance the aspirant from the ways of nature. Again, transcendence. In fertility rites, all rituals symbolize sex or offerings of flower, grass, sandal paste, incense, or even blood sacrifice, the breaking of coconuts, offering and consuming of food. In monastic practices, all practices are anti-sex. Celibacy, discarding bright clothes, perfume, sandal paste, flowers, jewelry, smearing the body with ash. Well, that's the Shaivites. Not to draw attention to yourself. Anti-violence, fasting, vegetarianism. In fertility rites, people appreciate sex and violence as fundamental principles rotating through the cycle of life. In monasticism, it abhors sex and violence as it these things bind creatures to the unending cycle of death and rebirth. In fertility rites, the final destination is paradise, the heavenly planets, the higher realms, material realms, not spiritual, where earthly joys never cease, even for a moment, where the flesh is immortal. There's a much, much higher level, a place to go for sense gratification, if you want, unbridled sense gratification on a much higher level than earth. And it is possible. But when you go there, you have X amount of credits. And when those credits are exhausted, down you come. That's how it works. And in monastic practices, the final destination is liberation from the fleshly body, repeated birth and death. Some people think merging with God, and some people see themselves in relationship with God. Well, we've talked about that before, the different levels of God consciousness. In fertility rites, they seek material comfort. In spiritual rites, they seek eternal spiritual bliss. Fertility rites are worldly. Monastic rites are otherworldly. All right. Questions? Interesting?
Oh, you know what I read the other day? The reason Ganesh rides a rat is because, being the remover of obstacles, he rather than being a nuisance, he has the ending of control.
Ah, very good.
It's conquering the nuisance. I bet you know a few, one or two rats that might be nuisances that you'd like to conquer. No, they could be people or they could be circumstances. All right, so let's do some meditation. Are you going to do one tonight? No? All right. Close your eyes. Breathe, relax, and let go. Deeply. Deeply relax. And let go. Allow the stress, tension, fear, and apprehension to drain from your body totally, completely. Relax, breathe, and let go. Breathe and let go. Relax. High above, envision a beautiful beam of radiant pearl white light coming down, down, all the way down, entering through the top of your head, expanding throughout your head, torso, arms and legs, out the bottom of your feet, or your base chakra, and into the earth below. Breathe, relax, and let go. See and feel yourself connected to the heavens above and grounded in the earth below. Relax. Deeply, deeply relax. Let go. All right. You're entering a city, and as you come along the great road into the city through the gates, on one side is a beautiful temple or church, a beautiful spiritual building used for divine purposes. On the other side is an exquisite palace, a place of power, beauty, status, and authority. Which one will you enter? The holy place, the spiritual place, on the one hand, or the palace of power and status on the other? Which do you enter? Enter it now. Walk through the main door and what do you see within? Notice the inside of the temple or the palace in as much detail as possible. Somebody is there to greet you. Who is there to greet you? How do they greet you? What is their attitude or disposition when they see you? What do they want to show you, or what do they need to tell you? What would they like to show you, or what do they need to tell you? Continue until you've finished all the steps of the meditation. You can take a few more moments to develop it further, if you like. And what is the ultimate outcome for you, having chosen the palace or the temple? When you're complete, you may return to consciousness, awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed, and at peace. All right. The temple or the palace?
What's the significance of the left and the right?
Left is the subconscious, and the right is the conscious. The left is feminine, the right is masculine. The left is the creative, abstract, artistic, more of the soul side. The right is more the logical, rational, clinical, analytical, more of that masculine power side of things. In yoga understanding, there is a channel that runs up and down the spine, through which the kundalini, when it's activated, moves up the spine through the chakras. And this channel is called the sushumna. On the left side is a nerve, for lack of a better term, nadi. And the left side is called the ida. And that's the moon channel. Feminine energy is moon energy. On the right side is the pingala, the sun channel, masculine channel. That's why the right side is always associated with the male energy. This is not like somebody, an arbitrary thing. That's where the male energy resides in terms of the chakras. And the left side, the moon energy, resides on the left side of the body.
Do you know when they're doing puja in India, that's why they only put the red cord on the male on the right hand and female on the left. Because I remember
the red what?
The red cord when you put in the puja.
Yeah,
my put it on the right. And I remember I put my right hand and then the pandit said to me, no, left, and I said, now. But you insist to put it on the left.
Because you're a female.
Yeah, because you're a
female. There you go. All right, so thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Om Tat Sat. Hare Krishna.